what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now. Because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
And now, live from Jerusalem, you're listening to Israel Inspired Radio. Here are your hosts, Rabbis Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
Shalom, you are listening to the Land of Israel Network on thelandofisrael.com. Heartbreaking words. That always touches me. I always get goosebumps listening to the prophetic words of Reverend Martin Luther King, because that was his last speech that he gave before he was shot and killed. And he went up to the mountain, and that's what happened in this week's Torah portion. Hashem said to Moshe, "Go up to the mountain of Avarim and see the land that I have given to the children of Israel. You shall see it, and you shall be gathered unto your people." You're not going to be able to enter the land. But I think there was deeper connections between Moshe Rabbeinu and Martin Luther King. But before we talk about those great leaders, we got another great leader right here, Jeremy Gimpel.
Well, thank you, Ari.
That's good company, huh?
Very nice company. I appreciate you.
So what do you feel when you listen to that Martin Luther King speech?
You know, I often when I speak to younger audiences, I talk about many times Martin Luther King Jr. References back to the story of the Jewish people. And he talks about breaking the bondages of slavery and traveling through the deserts and climbing the mountaintop and peering into the promised land. And it's almost as if the story of the Jewish people inspired the civil rights movement in the United States, of the concept of Adam Nivra B'Tzelem Elohim, that man was created in the image of God, and it doesn't matter what color your skin is, but all man was created in the image of God. And to think that the story of the Jewish people for so many thousands of years has shifted global consciousness, has changed the way the world sees humanity, the way the world sees each other, and the Jewish people continue to change the world.
Well, I also think there's a reason that out of all the civil rights leaders, there's Martin Luther King Day. Because he was the most successful. And why? Because he was, in my opinion, even though I really have grown to a certain affection for Malcolm X, which is a little curious because he wasn't the biggest fan of the Jews, but there's something about him I deeply respect. But Martin Luther King saw the good in, he said to America, "You're better than this. Look at your own words." I think the parallels between Moshe Rabbeinu, when it was clear that he was not going to enter the land, he says, "May Hashem appoint someone who will go out and come in before them, who will take them out and bring them in." And so I was reading that. It's like really sort of curious wording. What does that mean to take them out and bring them in? And Rabbi Weiss brings Rabbi Zweig's explanation. He says that a leader has two roles, to lead by example as well as to direct the people as to what needs to be done. Right? Leading by example, they both did that. Moshe gave up on privilege and position of royalty for Am Yisrael. He suffered for them. He took responsibility for their sins, right? Remember, he said, "Macheni na mesifrecha." If you're going to erase this people, God, erase me too. And Martin Luther King, not only did he suffer for the cause, but he died for his cause, and he also led by example. And so there's a certain power to that type of leadership. But it's also meaningful for me because as I was reading this here, it was right on my balcony, my mirpeset, and I'm looking over at the very mountains that Moses looked into the land from, right? It's right here.
It's right here. Like we're looking back at him from inside the land. And I would think about that. Maybe in some ways he was looking into the land and also looking into the future, seeing what Israel would eventually become. Because even in the words of the Torah, it says twice that the Jewish people will be exiled from the land and will be restored to the land. And Moshe is the one that wrote these words. So he had a vision of not only entering into the land in the times of Joshua, but entering into the land in the times of Nefesh B'Nefesh. And he was able to see what Israel would be. And so looking back at him where we are right now is just marvelous.
Right. And he was the greatest of all prophets. So they say in a sort of a skin-tingling Dvar Torah idea that when the prophets entered the land, they prophesized and saw all of the blood and wars and horror that were going to happen to the Jewish people there. And what Rav Shlomo says is that they didn't realize at the time that that was because of them.
The spies.
That was because of the spies, all those things that were going to happen because of what they were just about to do. But they allowed the vision of the outcome to so terrify them that they brought about that outcome themselves. Mm. Interestingly enough, but Moshe, it's rational, logical to think that when he looked into the land, he saw the entire thing from the beginning to the end, not only geographically, but also chronologically. And one of my favorite Torah ideas that I love to share when people come out here to the farm is that the Bach, he says that, why did Moshe want to enter the land? To eat the fruits of the land of Israel. You can't eat the soil, the actual earth of the land that we know has sparks of tremendous holiness. So when you eat the fruits and the grains of the land of Israel, you are integrating that into your system. Every 7 years, our body is regenerated based on what we eat. So when you eat the fruits and the grains of the land of Israel, your physical body becomes the land of Israel. But I actually thought of something the other night that was even deeper than that. Why is that so perfect? Because at least for me and my understanding of my Jewish experience, it's that in the exile, my Judaism was an external, more superficial part. It was one of the different descriptions. Yes, it was always a very central one, but it was one of the many things that I did. It wasn't like the totality of me. I didn't live and breathe it. But here, when at least for me, and I believe the Jewish people in general, when we're in Israel, it becomes a holistic, integrated totality where we connect with the land into our Jewish identity and to God and to each other in such a deeper, more holistic way than we could ever do simply by intellectually learning things and feeling it. It's a product of actually being here on the land itself.
You know, you talk about exile Judaism, and I think that the quintessential exile Judaism is Reform Judaism. You know, Reform Judaism was established in the 1800s by German Jews, and their entire purpose was to leave the Jewish people, to leave the nation of Israel. They erased the return to Zion, to rebuilding Jerusalem.
They started, their ceremonies resemble those of churches more.
Right. The rabbis started dressing up like Christian priests. The synagogues were built in a way to just allow them to be Germans of Mosaic persuasion. And now Reform Judaism is in this, just articles and articles are being written all of the time now about their claim to the Kotel, to the Western Wall, and how they want to change the Jewish way of worship, which has, you know, been this way since the times of the temple, that men are on one side and women are on another side, creating a certain level of modesty and focus in prayer and not checking each other out at our holiest site. And I just find it, well, this is going to be a little bit politically incorrect, but I find it infuriating in the hypocrisy of it all. I mean, the Reformed Jews that did see Judaism as just like, I'm a Yankees fan, I'm an American, I also, by the way, I have this Reformed Judaism thing that maybe I'll go to synagogue once a month, but they systematically erased Israel, Jerusalem, being a Jew from their theology. In fact, it's the Reformed Jews that are the biggest, most vocal advocates for surrendering any land that was captured in 1967. The Kotel was captured in 1967. What is their now attachment to the Kotel if they've theologically detached themselves from Israel, from Zion, from Jerusalem? It just seems like hypocrisy heaped up with more hypocrisy, and that's why Reform Judaism in the United States, there's now an 80 to 90% assimilation rate, because it's just fluff on top of fluff mixed in with hypocrisy that doesn't make any sense.
Okay, well, when you say hypocrisy on top of hypocrisy, I just have to, for me, it resonates that I feel like I see a lot of hypocrisy in myself and these Reform Jews. Literally, what more can you expect? They've never gotten any authentic Torah concepts taught to them, authentic Jewish education. Everything that they've been taught is simply built in to that worldview, from their bar mitzvah, which is just a symbolic ceremony that costs $150,000, where they bring in Snoop Dogg to rap, and they're like, well, that's Judaism.
Well, no, well, so,
I'm saying I don't disagree with your point. I actually think it's quite insightful, but I think we need to be more generous.
Well, I would say that the Reformed Jews, generous isn't even the word, it's compassionate. I pity them. I'm so sad that they've been robbed of 4,000 years of heritage, that they don't know the first thing about what it is to be a Jew.
To be generous, to understand that, yes, you're right, they've been robbed, but there's something inside them that's still like, I'm not going to just walk away from this. I'm going to be a Reformed Jew. There's something in their soul that's like, I am a Jew, and I'm going, this is the way it makes the most sense to me. I understand it now, it manifests to me, but at least they're not just like, I don't care.
I think my words were more directed at their political leadership than the actual Reformed Jews themselves.
It's the blind leading the blind. That's the truth. That's the truth. We have many, many Jews from around the world listen to our show. Christians listen to our show. I would bet that you could take the average Jew or Christian listener on our show, rabbi, pastor, or not, and they would be able to out-Bible the average Reform rabbi. I mean, there's just so much confusion. There's so much confusion. You know, Donald Trump, I just heard an interview that he did with Huckabee. And Huckabee asked him about the embassy. Listen to this.
The embassy was moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I was there. It was as surreal a moment as I've ever witnessed. You made that promise. You kept that promise. What was it that just made you decide to do what no other president, even though they had promised it as well, what made you decide, I'm going to do this because I said I would?
Well, the embassy was a big thing, but it was for many presidents before me, and everybody campaigned that they were going to move the embassy to Jerusalem, and nobody did it. And I never understood why. I really never did. I knew there would be pressure, but I never understood. But I do understand now, because 2 weeks before I did it, when the word was out that I was going to do it, I was called by so many countries saying, please don't do it. I mean, I was called, actually got to a point where I said, I'll call you back in a week, because I didn't want to have them tell me don't do it, and then I do it, because I was going to do it. It was a campaign promise. I thought it was very important. And you know who really likes it the most are the evangelicals. I'll tell you what, I get more calls of thank you from evangelicals, and I see it in the audiences and everything else, than I do from Jewish people. And the Jewish people appreciate it, but the evangelicals appreciate more than the Jews, which is incredible. But
it's not a surprise, though, Mr. President, because evangelicals are people of the book, and they believe that you kept a promise that was fulfilling really 3,000-year-old commitment to recognize Jerusalem as the capital.
I think it's a nice thing to say, because it really, I mean, you know, it really affects Jewish people in theory more.
Yeah.
But as you say, people of the book, okay, yeah, people of the Bible. But the evangelicals really appreciate it, and that makes me feel good. But nobody did it. I never understood why. As soon as that second week had up, and once I did it, it was something very special. It's an important event.
You know, polls were taken, and it said that the majority of American Jews were not happy with the embassy move to Jerusalem. And that's like exactly what we're talking about, how the American Jewish community...
I think it was 30% that actually supported it.
Yeah, 30%. And so,
and in Israel, 80%. And if those statistics are wrong, someone has to show me, because I was sent links to exactly those numbers. But, you know, that's but I was reading an article just yesterday that it started off and I thought it was one thing. And then when I found out what it actually was, it blew my mind. Okay, I was so shocked and surprised by it. It's by this guy, Angus Johnson. I'm pretty sure he's a Jew from the infuriatingly insane tone of the article. And I say that with all love in my heart. But he was talking about an American professor named Henry Cadbury in 1934. And he urged the Jews to be civil to the Nazis. Right now, I thought this article was going in the direction that makes the most sense to me, is that why do leftist Jews turn against Israel? There were parties that were saying Jews for Hitler and support Hitler in some sort of hope that if they side with the enemies of Israel, that somehow they'll be exempt. They'll be the good Jews. But that's not what he was saying. He said, so this professor, he quoted, said, by hating Hitler and fighting back, Jews are only increasing the severity of the policies against them. So he spoke for civility. And this Angus Johnston guy, Johnson, he went on to parallel Hitler to Trump, saying Jews should learn from this and should not be civil and have to stand against Trump no matter what. And,
comparing Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler?
Get to Adolf Hitler.
It's like unbelievable.
The president that at least I must throw my hat in the ring here and say he has been the best president to Jews. I mean, you heard what he said. The nations are calling him. The reason that he said all of these presidents wanted to move the embassy, but they didn't, is because when it actually came down to it, they didn't have the fortitude and the strength and the character to stand up to the world when the whole world is saying, don't do this.
But like, I find that part most interesting.
I love it.
Why was the whole world calling President Donald Trump to say, no, don't move the embassy. Don't move the embassy. What is their obsession?
So I'll tell you what I think the obsession is. And it's not some sort of sinister Jew hatred. I don't think so. I think it's just a pragmatism. It's like, do we want the powder keg of the Middle East to explode? Do we want a world war? Don't move the embassy. There's not a global war with mass casualties of hundreds of millions in nuclear war. It's such a powder keg over here.
Do you know what it is? It's almost like Europe wants to die, but they want to die slowly. And it's kind of like make it as painless as possible, but they're going to die. They're committing suicide. They're not having children. They're bringing millions of Muslims into their country. And it's like they've like given up on winning this. And Donald Trump's like, no, we want Israel to be strong because Israel is America's ally and we want to win this war.
I love it. By the way, that's one of his approaches that I really respect and am grateful for, that he doesn't pull this thing that past presidents have pulled, that it's some sort of magnanimous, benevolent gesture of why they support Israel. No, that's not it. America is Israel's ally. Yes, there's shared values, but there's also shared interests. And Israel is critical for America on military front, strategic front, intelligence front, on many different fronts. And it's much more of an eye-to-eye respectful relationship. At least that's the feeling I get with Trump. But I just like the fact he said, call me next week, because he didn't want to have to say, he already knew he was going to do it. He's going to do it. And sometimes I just think about him, he's like sort of so impulsive that massive historical moves he'll decide, like, while he's eating a Burger King.
I don't know if that's true. I think he made a campaign promise saying this is the right thing to do.
No,
he's just going to do what's right.
When you listen to the interview with Huckabee, he's talking about this issue and that issue, and the move of the embassy, meaning it was an important thing, but it was a thing that he did last week.
Right.
and it was like huge.
You know what's
huge.
Interesting? You know, Netanyahu just came out saying that members of Knesset are now allowed once again to ascend the Temple Mount, meaning, you know, if you ever want to know what's happening in the world, what's happening in Israel, what's happening to the Jewish people, what's happening really in the heart of God, I believe, is you see what's happening on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. That really is like the epicenter of it all. And that move to Jerusalem, the embassy move, it's going to have ripple effects for many, many years. And we can already see things are just shifting all around the world.
Things are. Slovakia just said last week that they're now moving their embassy to Jerusalem and joining the other countries that are.
Australia just declared that they're ending all direct aid to the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, he's really...
He's changing the world order.
He's changing... I don't like the world order idea, but he's changing the world, okay?
I don't know. What's the difference?
you know, there's a lot of whatever, the New World Order, the World Order. It's just, there's a lot of baggage there for a lot of people that are in the know.
Okay,
I'm just
saying that there's structures within the world right now with the European Union controlled by Germany that, you know, are moving and shaking and taking things, and he's rattling the cage. He's shaking things up and he's reordering what was the order up until now.
That's right. And I always get a little bit embarrassed, you know, when I know that Huckabee didn't mean this in a negative way. Okay, because at first I took offense to it, and then I sort of thought deeper about what he was saying. But when he said, it's not surprising, evangelicals are people of the book, right? So I was like, well, Jews are people of the book, but...
Not really.
Well, here's the thing. Jews are people of the book. Now, not every Jew in America, is an overwhelmingly identifying Jew, but not all, and also not in Israel. Judaism is definitely of the book, and the nation of Israel are the people of the book on a macro level. But he's saying, you know, there's many, many, many Christians. Now, evangelical Christians, if they identify themselves as such, it's the equivalent of a Jew identifying himself as a God-fearing, Torah-observant Jew.
I would love to know the stats on how many American Jews have read the Tanakh from cover to cover.
I'm sure that no poll has been taken on that.
That it is so small, because the ultra-Orthodox American Jews don't really learn the Tanakh. The conservative to reform, I don't know how much Torah they study at all, never mind cover to cover. I just feel like when he says, like, listen, the Christians are the people of the book and the Jews in America are not.
Yeah, just yesterday on my balcony shows up a family and their little baby. And I said, what's the baby's name? And they said, Asael. They said, you know who Asael was? And I said, I made a little running gesture because he was the one that ran light on his feet. And that Avner killed. And, you know, just walking through the streets of Jerusalem, you need to know the Tanakh if you want to know who all the characters are that the streets are named after. Just meeting the people here. The people that pull out names from the Tanakh, from the deepest, most obscure places, and share deep reasons why those are their names, which is why this article is so twisted. This guy is saying we need to learn from the civility and the appeasement of by Jews of Hitler for Hitler before the Holocaust and turn against Trump. It's the exact opposite of the point, the exact opposite. So antithetical to the truth that he's saying, no, we need to turn against Trump, who has been the best to Jews, to over-identify with this leftist liberal agenda that we have come to identify as us over our very Judaism. That's why in this week's Torah portion, right, it's Pinchas, the zealot, and then the Haftorah. The part that we read from the prophets is about Elijah the prophet when he's running away from the king, Ahab and Jezebel. And he's running away. Why? Because he just stood in front of the entire nation of Israel and they were worshiping, so many of them were worshiping Baal. And they also worship the God of Israel. And he said, Ad matai atem poskim oshtei seifim? Until when are you going to stand on both sides of the fence? Right? That's what I feel like these American Jews have, aren't only standing on both sides of the fence. They've jumped to the other side altogether, and they don't even know that they're on the other side.
Well, here's, you know,
that's the tragedy.
You know, it says that the first redemption is a blueprint for the final redemption. And it says that, you know, Chamushim alu b'nei Israel me'eretz Mitzrayim, that we went up armed. And then Rashi says, Chamushim is only... one-fifth. And if you look at the assimilation rate of American Jews today, it's, you know, it's about 80%. And it seems as though there is this process of elimination, that it could be that this 80% of the American Jews in another generation or two are really just meant to disappear into the nations. And then maybe at some point, you know, they'll marry some Christian, and then that Christian person will realize, oh my goodness, my father or my grandfather was a Jew. I mean, we meet so many people like that now.
Just every time I hear that type of talk, which is not infrequent, I have an internal natural aversion that is so overwhelming that is almost the conviction of... I don't want to say like prophetic, but it feels like I just know that that's not a relevant comment in another generation or two. We don't have another generation or two of being in America. We just don't. I feel so, I could be wrong here, but I feel so overwhelmingly strong because also when you look, this is an interesting study I'd like to do. The degree, the level of assimilation in countries that have hosted Jews throughout the years, and at what level of assimilation does the natural, does the host country turn against the Jews, right? Because at a certain point, it's a tipping point and a nation just disappears into history. and assimilates, and that's just the way the natural order goes. But as that's happening to Jews who often are running at top speed with their arms open to embrace the assimilated idea and to leave their Judaism behind, when it gets to a certain tipping point, like in Nazi Germany, 70 plus percent of Jews were intermarried. They were in the arts and the sciences and the government. They were so deeply integrated into German society. You could tell if they were a Jew, if they were more patriotic to Germany than the average German.
Yeah, but there's something that's different about the United States than Germany or Spain.
Yeah, of course, there's many differences.
But it's pretty fundamental, meaning all of the other exiles of the past, the countries had very strong national identities as Germans, as Spaniards. In America, it's a country of immigrants where people are coming from Mexico and from China and from all over, integrating into this big pot called the United States.
It's always different. So of course there's different, but to me, just replace nationalism with ideological. The world is being globalized, and the parties, the camps are really, the dust is settling, and it's people with conservative biblical values and those that are leftist and liberal and are more humanist and not nationalist or religious. Those are the different camps. So instead of saying nationalism, shift it with leftism. Okay? And that's the new assimilation or sprint towards assimilation.
Okay. So I don't understand that. So then why doesn't American Jews have another generation or two in the United States if there's two camps? So obviously,
because every time that we try to assimilate and be like the Gentiles and leave our Judaism behind, God says no. Other nations, yes, you no. And the very people who we're trying to assimilate into are, as if a spirit has overtaken them, repulsed by us.
But can I tell you why I think
they turn against us? At a certain tipping point that I feel like is being reached already.
It could be that you're right, but on the other hand, the difference this day is that the state of Israel is growing and thriving. It really could be that the Jews outside of the state of Israel, it could be that there'll be persecution like there was in France and there'll be mass.
Yeah, I'm not saying, you keep on drawing exact parallels, and I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that there's going to be a concentration camps. I don't think America's made of that fabric. That's not the way it would go. It will be different, but there will be a repulsion, following conversation will happen. But I believe I'm with you. So what if I'm a Jew? You're going to not let me be a part? I believe in your cause more. I'll fight with you. No, you're a Jew and you have dual loyalties and a push towards forcing Jews into their Jewish identity, and which will bring them into a greater aliyah. I don't know how things will play out, but I feel very strongly that this is going to turn back on them. And think we don't have the next generation, the next 10 years is not going to resemble the last 10 years. That's what I'm saying. That things are going to be different moving forward, that we're in a time of tremendous volatility. And to talk about two generations from now as if things will just continue on. We talked about the black swan idea also, that the external global events shift the very course of nature and to extrapolate time into the future as if it's just going to all continue without any exogenous events. That's all I'm saying. Now, before we move on, because there's just, you know, lately I've been really dipping into the Torah portion for strength. We believe that the events of the Torah portion very much are influenced and integrated and woven in with time, where we're at, what the actual week looks like. So I feel like I'm able to get strength from that. But I just wanted to check in with you, because this is a pretty big transition. We haven't seen each other much this week, because you have been with your family, packing up your life.
My whole life.
Your whole life.
We're having a big yard sale today, giving away so much stuff that we've collected over the years. Because we're getting ready to move to the mountain.
Moving to the mountain.
Yeah.
You know, Moshe wanted that more than anything.
Yeah. You know, it's you talk about this week's Torah portion, and there was a moment where I just very much identified with Pinchas, where Pinchas just saw what needed to be done, and it's like, I'm not going to think this through. I'm just going to go and do it. I know what's right. The Rambam talks about serving God in the highest manner, and the Rambam says, Oseh et ha'emet mipnei shehi ha'emet. Just doing the truth because it's the truth, not because you're looking for some sort of reward in the world to come, or not because you think that you might get punished if you don't, but just doing what's right because it's right.
Right. So here's, I'm so glad you said that, because someone just asked me last night, we were talking about the parsha, and he said, would you do what Pinchas did? So for me, I've had to think about it. I said, the answer is, if I felt it in my heart, that sort of finger of Hashem touch that I've on this journey through life, and especially since living out here in the hills of Judea, I've been like, oh, that's a God feeling. I need to go with that intuition right there. It's hard to put, you can't describe it in words, but if you're led to do something, you know in your heart, this is what you need to do, you don't run it through the filter of your brain first.
Well, so here's the challenge that I'm going through at this point in the game, is that...
let me just guess, and then you tell me.
Okay. Because
I look at you, and I feel like you are now in the point, after Pinchas killed the Cozbi and Zimri, and before any consequences happen yet, and you're like, I just did that, because you're already in. You've already jumped over to the other side. It's been done. Your house is sold. Legally, the police will evict you from your home okay. if you don't leave in 3 weeks. This has happened already. So although you're not living out here yet, it's already happened. Is that sort of where you're at?
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm at. There's the Midrash talks about Avraham, you know, having this God moment where he's called to bring up Isaac as a sacrifice in Jerusalem. And, you know, he has this incredible, powerful conviction that he believes, that he feels is God's will in his life. And then he picks up Isaac and they start walking to Jerusalem. And then the Midrash says that for 3 days he had no contact with God. And he just felt very alone. And then the Midrash goes on and like colorfully, you know, articulates that, you know, all these doubts start creeping into Abraham. He meets the Satan himself and starts convincing this is not the right thing to do. It's immoral. Are you sure you want to do this? This isn't even, how is your seed going to continue if you kill Isaac? Throwing all of these doubts into him. And Avraham is all alone, kind of looking up for God, looking for that moment of confirmation, saying, Hashem, am I doing the right thing? And Hashem leaves him totally alone, just walking for 3 days with no confirmation, with no encouragement, with no sense of where did that God feeling go? I'm doing this thing and I'm on my way to sacrifice Isaac, but I feel very alienated right now. And so, you know, I've jumped in, I've done this Pinchas moment trying to follow the truth of what I believed was the right thing for me in my life. But at this stage in the game, I feel very alone. I'm having these moments where I wake up in the morning and I'm just overwhelmed with fear and anxiety. And I just, I wake up and I go to shul and I put my talus over my head and I'll just burst out crying. And I don't even know what I'm crying about. And I'm just like with my talus and my tefillin just crying in shul. I don't think anyone sees me because my talus is over my head. And then I kind of let all of this pent up emotions out. And then I kind of start my day and I'm like, all right, gather myself together and let's start packing and we're moving out to this mountain.
Yeah, and you said to me something the other day, I feel like sometimes you say things to sort of talk yourself down. And you said a very good point. You said, Tehillah is so strong that if she's happy, you said that you were afraid that she would think that you are...
Well, listen, you know, I'm moving out here and my house isn't complete yet. And we have things that we need to do. We're probably going to have to tent it out somewhere, camp out somewhere until the house is finished.
It was going to be done by the time you needed to move out of your house.
Yeah, you know, and I thought it was going to be...
I feel like, isn't that construction 101 that it's never done?
It's never
the time
done.
That I would have done the same thing.
Yeah, anyway, you know, we've already like...
The guy looks like he knows what he's talking about, but it's built into the code. Yeah,
this is just like what we've done. Like, we have consequences now. We've just, you know, slayed Zimri and Cozbi, and we're like, uh-oh. Was that the right thing to do? Like, our house is sold. We are leaving in 3 weeks. And, you know, it's just, it's a little bit of a terrifying time. I feel like I'm learning a little bit how to walk. But then I think about, you know, I'm about to release, you know, my music album probably after I move here. And we just, you know, finished filming the music video and I'm really excited about it.
I'm playing the triangle, which
makes the whole video. It's the best video. And, you know, I try in the video to sort of capture the last 3 years of being out on this mountain. And it was just alone in ecstatic prayer and worship with my guitar, singing to God, thanking him and praising him for bringing me to this mountain and allowing me to be alive in these days to see the miracles of the things that are happening on this mountain. And it's just like this amazing music video with drone footage of me on the mountain playing the guitar overlooking this cliff and these amazing views here. And now I look at myself and I'm like quivering and trembling and davening, crying, feeling very alone. And I'm like, wow, this is like, is that the same person? And, you know, I've been struggling, like, why is this a part of the spiritual journey? Meaning it seems to be built into the system. The fact that Avraham had a moment of inspiration, he had to act on that moment of inspiration, and then was left alone.
That's what I've been telling you, and I want you to continue. But over the years, the 20 years of our friendship, or however many years it is, almost that, for some reason, it's become like I grade myself, and sometimes you say, you ask for a grade on how you're doing in life, and you know I'm a hard grader, right? I can count on one hand where I've ever given you an A, but I feel like you have an A.
That's really nice,
like,
to hear.
Even though you're anxious and you're crying, but considering the wave of what Hashem is sending over you, in my perception at least, this is the, you are, your family is depending on you, and you are holding them. You know, you're keeping this inside, and you're a rock for Tehillah and for the kids. And I could just see that things are in a good way in your
house. Well, let me tell you, if there's anyone that's a rock, it's not me for Tehillah, it's Tehillah for me. She is such a hero. I mean, she has no nervousness at all. She knows she's had dreams about this place since she was 18. This was her dream.
Hashem, you said that she's like, if it's not ready, we'll go stay here. We'll stay
there. Yeah,
we'll
stay there. We'll figure it out. We'll live in a tent. We'll move to my parents' house. We'll go somewhere. Don't worry. You know, it says that Eretz Yisrael niknet bi yisurim. The land of Israel is acquired through hardships. And so we are doing our step to acquire this part of the land of Israel. And, you know, I think about it sometimes by just taking a step back. We are pioneering the deepest settlement in southeastern Judea. We are literally at the tip of the spear. And that's going to go, there's going to be Yisurim. I mean, yeah. I knew that when I came here, that I was stepping into shoes that were a little bit big for me. But, you know, this is the chance to really
That's one way to put it. I think I remember our conversations a little bit clearer than that. I don't think we said, this is a little bit bigger than for our... No, we're like, what in the world? It's by many exponents beyond anything that we've ever encountered before.
So I want to just share with you, you know, what are my thoughts about why is this a part of the journey? You know, Rabbi Nachman talks about the idea of Ratzov Vashov, that Yaakov saw angels ascending to heaven and descending from heaven. And Rabbi Nachman teaches that our relationship with God is in a constant waxing and waning. Times of closeness where you have ecstatic prayer on a mountaintop, and then times of sadness where you feel so distant, alienated, and alone. And I was like, well, what is the purpose here of these times of being alone? And I feel like right now, you know, there's a lot of doubts that are creeping in. There's a lot of like fears that are creeping in. And I feel like there's a time now that I'm able to serve Hashem lishma, where it's just serving God for the sake of serving God. That without doubt, then yeah, man, of course I'm doing it. I'm with God. I'm with Olam Haba. I'm with the world to come. I have all of these things. But when I feel all alone, it's almost like serving God within a place of doubt is allowing me to really serve God truly.
For the sort of Kabbalists out there, I would say the point you're at now is you're raising the sparks from the lowest places that they've fallen. Does that make sense to you?
A little bit. I mean, I wish I knew.
Wait, the lowest places they've fallen, meaning the places of questions and confusion and doubt and stepping forward in that. Sometimes, you know, I think even if you have all the clarities and the mantras and the realizations of Hashem running the world, there are going to be times where a spirit is put over you of fear and doubt and confusion. Then the question is, how do you operate from there? That's to determine whether you raise the sparks
right.
or not.
And so can I serve God without that kind of feedback of feeling close to him? Can I serve God from a place of just doing what's right because I know that it's right? And I feel like in some ways it's kind of teaching me to walk in the world. You know, like, you know, when I remember when Noam was just learning how to walk, so you kind of hold his hand a little bit and then you want to let go and see if he can take a few more steps. So I feel like in some ways Hashem is also allowing me to feel like what it is to be independent, what it is to walk in the world. And I've also really started to identify a little bit more with secular Jews and secular people in general, to realize that there is a spectrum of spirituality. The same way that there's, you know, a genius in IQ and there's retardation in IQ. There's like people that have brilliant minds. So also in spirituality, there's a spectrum. There are people that are spiritual geniuses. Let's call those people the prophets. And there's people that have, you know, a spiritual autism that they just, they can't feel God. They can't see God. They don't feel it. It's just, it's another sense that can either be overdeveloped or underdeveloped. But I find that in the spiritual spectrum, all of us kind of are on a pendulum where we rock back and forth. And I was talking to Tahila about it, and she says, you know, every real relationship, you know, between husband and wife, there are times of intimacy, and then there's times of distance. There are times of nida, where you're separate from your wife, and there's times of closeness where you're allowed to be with your wife. And so a living, breathing, real relationship has times of distance and times of closeness. And it seems as though I'm really being challenged to my core, because if there was ever a time that I would like Hashem to be holding my hand, it's like the 3 weeks before I'm leaving my home, moving out into the pioneering mountains of Judea. But for one reason or another, he's just kind of sent me off on my own. And I guess this is just my walk with Isaac and my family, hoping that before, you know, the angel will appear and say, like, all right, you've made it. Welcome.
Right. So I'll just say that this one part from this week's Torah portion, I think, really speaks to you right now. And it's funny because, you know, Chassidut is so beautiful. It's so deep, and it brings out the different dimensions of Torah. And someone that doesn't understand the multifaceted, multi-dimension concept of the Torah would be like, what? You got that from those words? How does that even make sense if you look at it like a linear thing written by a person, as opposed to the deepest multi-infinite levels of wisdom? Of course it's going to be that if you believe that the God that created the complexity of this world poured his wisdom into it. So the words, it's talking about the census. Ready for this, Jeremy? It's beautiful. The Bris Avram says this, that it says, Uvnei Palu Eliav. What does that mean? And Palu's son is Eliav. It's just like, you know, words in the, when it's talking about the sons of this and this in the census. But what he says is Palu means concealed, concealed. So Uvnei Palu, people who are in a world of concealment right now, Eliav, need to remember, Eli, God is their father.
A world of concealment means that Hashem is concealed from them. They can't see Hashem.
People who are right now, Bnei Palu, children of concealment, meaning like they are now in a world of concealment. They don't see Hashem everywhere. Remember, Eliav, God is your father. So, you know, in Shir HaShirim, it says that Hashem is mashkiach min hachalonot, matzitz min hacharakim, right? That he's observing us through the windows and peeking through the crevices or the cracks in the wall. And, you know, sometimes you read this stuff and it just sounds poetic and like they just wanted to make more sentences. But when you understand that that's maybe how I would write a poem to just sound poetic, that's really not. There's different ideas being conveyed here. So when you're observing through a window, so let's say your father is observing you through the window. You see him, and he sees you. You see each other through the window. But when he's peeking through a crevice or a crack in the wall, you look at the wall, you don't see him. But he sees you, and not only that, when he's peeking through the crack and you don't see him, and he's focused more on you than when he's looking through the window.
Because there's no peripheral vision.
No peripheral vision. It's all on you. And that's what I think it's important to remember right now, especially during this move, that while you may not feel it and see Hashem's hand right now, A, it's not your fault. And B, he is focused more on you. He's more with you than when you may feel it.
Yeah, I really find the marvel and wonder of the perfect balance for free choice. That Hashem reveals himself just enough for us to have emunah and just enough for us to actually feel totally alone, independent, and alienated on this, in this vast universe. It's like the perfect thin veil that is the perfect balance for us to really live an independent life with the option of peering into the other world.
Right. And, you know, I've been, sometimes we critique each other's presentations when we bring groups out here and people out here. And you said to me something yesterday that got me thinking. You said, you always tell people when they tell you, oh, Ari, what self-sacrifice, what mesirut nefesh that you live out there, that you live out here. And that's true. People say that to me, like, wow, you live out here, what self-sacrifice? And then I respond and say, zero. There's no self-sacrifice in living out here. And so from like a, you said to me from maybe a material place, you feel that way. But on other levels, you are suffering too. you are sacrificing for this place when it comes to a lot of the stresses of this place, the trying to keep the place afloat, the fundraising, there are challenges, deep, significant challenges, maybe not on the conventional
creature comforts,
but on other levels. And that's why I just want to touch into, for a second, I want to touch into what happened to Pinchas, because it's such an interesting thing. He killed Cozbi and Zimri. The Midianite women were coming in at Bilaam's advice to seduce the Israelite men, because when they understood that wars and military strategy isn't going to work, the only thing that's going to work against Israel is attacking them spiritually and interfering with their relationship with Hashem and turning Hashem against them. That's the only thing that will work. So the Midianite women came in to seduce the Israelite men, and in the middle of the camp, this prince from the tribe of Shimon is fornicating with Zimri, this Midianite princess, and Pinchas goes and kills them both. Now, he's a prince from the tribe of Israel. This is royalty that he's dealing with. He didn't think about what are the consequences of this. It was sort of David-like when he was like, who is this uncircumcised Philistine speaking against the armies of the living God of Israel? There was no like, well, what's he going to do to me? What's going to happen to me? Pinchas was so overwhelmed with the injustice, not the injustice, the desecration of God's name that's happening here right now, that he wasn't thinking about consequences. He felt that thing in his heart. And what did he get for it? The covenant of peace and the kahuna, priesthood. And they're both so illogical. Because think about why the covenant of peace, it's so obvious why that's such a strange thing to get for killing two people. Because, you know, there were people that were claiming, oh, he was a descendant of Yitro, and Yitro was an idolater who was more zealous, and so it was from a place of violence that he did that. That's why the Torah tells us that it was Pinchas all the way back to Aaron, right? Because he is the son of Aaron. The Torah was saying that. But who was Aaron? Aaron was an Ohev Shalom and Rodef Shalom, someone that loved peace and pursued peace, but he didn't actually get the covenant of peace. What are the stories? He used to go to a husband and say, listen, when they're fighting and there's about to be something bad that happens in a marital relationship, he goes to the husband and says, your wife really loves you and she misses you and she's really sorry. And then he goes to the wife and says, your husband is really sorry. And they come together and they make up, right? He sort of fudged things a little bit on the truth. He would sacrifice truth for peace. That's what Aaron did with the golden calf, right? He built a golden calf, even though it was idolatry, in order to keep peace in the camp. So he pursued peace, but the totality of peace, we understand, is Ohev Shal is Sur Merav Oseh Tov, right? Did I say that? Sur Merav Oseh Tov? Vaseh Tov. Is stray from evil, hate evil, and love good. There's two sides of things. And it's much more difficult for Jews in general to err on the side of the judgment part of it. You know, it's much easier to fudge the truth for peace because we're people that just want peace. So, but he went to the other side and he sacrificed peace for truth, right? And so this covenant of peace that he got, it actually really is the covenant of peace because he understood that there's a totality for peace that is both hating evil and embracing good. So he got the covenant of peace for killing two people. And then the priesthood to get kahuna is also illogical and irrational because think about it. A Kohen is usually, if there's a normal Kohen, a descendant of Aaron, and he kills someone, that invalidates his kahuna. He loses his priesthood for killing someone. And now Pinchas becomes a Kohen for killing someone, right? It's just totally the opposite. So why did he get priesthood for something that would normally invalidate a priest? I don't know what I'm saying, okay? It's just thoughts that I was having, and much of it is inspired by Rabbi Kahn. But what is the job of a Kohen who brings a sacrifice to bring atonement for the nation and for the Jewish people and for individual Jews? That's what a Kohen does. And that sacrifice, Pinchas sacrificed in some way Zimri, right? The blood of the evil is like a sacrifice. I know that sounds extreme, but there was a sacrifice. But even, what do I think the real sacrifice was? He sacrificed his comfort zone. What, obviously this wasn't something that was easy for him or that he wanted to do. That's why, just like you selling your house, you did it before thinking, Are we going to have security? There's no fences. There's no alarms. I have six kids. It's a building site. There are Arabs there. There's all of these wonderful, wonderful, valid, rational, pragmatic contentions that you could have taken into account. But you just said, I am just doing this, which is why when I tried to talk you out of it, not to talk you out of it, but just to give you the devil's advocate, you got mad at me. You're like, I don't want to hear it. This is just what's happening. You remember the little conversation I had with Tehillah about that, where you got upset at me for that, but I understand. But the point is, he said he went outside of his comfort zone. But for those who said, oh, he just was a zealot, we have the other side. And this is one of the things that people don't realize, that Pinchas actually went into the land of Israel. And when the tribes settled down, right, on the east side of the Jordan, there was Reuven, Gad, and Chatzim Menashe. Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Menashe. And this is not a midrashic thing or a rabbinic thing. You just open up to the 23rd chapter of the book of Joshua, where it tells what actually played out there, is that the tribes set up an altar there. And of course, this was right after Moses' warnings. And this was fresh in their minds about all the danger of Israel and idolatry and how that would be the worst thing ever. And the rest of the tribes see that they built an altar, and they were going to wipe out those 2.5 tribes. They were going to have a civil war. So they sent Pinchas down there to investigate. And he went and he had a conversation with them. And he said, oh, no, this is not an altar for foreign sacrificing gods. This is like a memorial symbolic altar. And he came back and said, and there was no war. Not one drop of blood was spilled. Now, if he was a zealot jumping to the sword every moment, he would have just moved to action and that's it. But no, he actually prevented, meaning that whichever way you want to say that his nature was predisposed him to being, he went the other side too. He expanded the range of his attributes. And that's what Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi says, that he's the head of Chabad, and he says it's about Chassidut, but really the Torah in general, is that the whole idea is for man to transform the nature of his character. That's it. That's what we need to be able to do. That's the calling. And that's why I think he became a Kohen, the priest, because he sacrificed his natural predisposition to act for God. That was not what he would naturally do. So then I think, what natural character attributes do we need to overcome as a nation, as individuals, and as people? Now get this, okay? I'm pretty sure this was from Rabbi Kahn, but hinted to this thing is the number of people that died in the plague that Pinchas stopped. You remember how many people?
No.
24,000 people died in the plague. Now, you know where else 24,000 people died? Pinchas's great-grandfather was Levi? No, not great-grandfather. Not his grandfather, his ancestor. The founder of the tribe was Levi. And Shimon was the ancestor of Zimri, the person who, and what do we remember about Shimon and Levi? That the city of Shechem, right, the prince of Shechem, his name was Shechem, he raped Dinah, and he wanted to marry her. And we don't know the backstory about what happened there, but he wanted to marry her, and they said, circumcise yourselves, and on the third day after the city circumcised themselves, they slayed the entire city, 24,000 people. Interesting, right? 24,000 people died in that when they slayed the city of Shechem, and 24,000 people died in the plague that Zimri caused by being with Cozbi. That's not a coincidence.
Definitely not.
And then 24,000 people also died when Rabbi Akiva's students, 24,000 people died. So now this is sort of where I'm going off on my own thing, my own thoughts, but I was thinking, what is like connecting this? And Rabbi Kahn definitely helped me on this, but I think I may have taken it. I'm taking responsibility for this because it may be a little off. I'm still working on the ideas. But what is the thing that is connecting all of that? And it's something that I think that we as Jews are struggling with now in our generation. And it's the balance between inclusivity and exclusivity, right? So Zimri's motivation was very much a peace now motivation. That's what we talked about last week. He says, let's just all be universal brothers. Let's all come together. He felt some sort of, our sages say that maybe he even was destined to be with Cozbi. And they were supposed to, that he knew a Moabite woman was going to be the father of Mashiach. He wants to connect with her on some deep spiritual, they don't paint him as an evil person. That's the bottom line. So he wanted this inclusivity of the world. Everybody is together. But when you look at Shimon and Levi, so that's where it goes. Again, there's two sides of it. So our sages say that why did this happen to Dinah? Well, when Jacob was going to meet Esau, he hid Dinah away so Esau wouldn't see her and want to marry her. And they fault Jacob for that, because perhaps if Jacob wasn't so exclusive, hiding Dinah from his brother, and understood that if he married Dinah, she may be an influence on him that could bring him back. So you're going to hide him from your brother? Well, then a foreign pagan idolater is going to rape her, right? And then once this did happen, and then they joined the Jewish people and they did circumcise themselves, then they wiped out 24,000 of them. That seems like an unnecessary exclusivity also on the tribe of Shimon and Levi, perhaps. Perhaps they were supposed to join. The point is that there's this tension between inclusivity and exclusivity, although also to Rabbi Akiva's students. They were exclusive in the sense that they didn't honor each other. They weren't open to entertaining each other's ideas, and they didn't treat each other with respect. So that, you know, is on the other side. So they're all sort of connected. And as Jews, I think we struggle with this issue so much. And when I think about what's going on in my mind, still the peace now thing is going on in my mind, because this war is not over. You know, hopefully it is. Maybe it is. What do I know?
Well,
seems like we have to brace ourselves and understand that more is coming.
Well, ultimately, you know, they put out tweets against us, and then they put out this article, and they came to scare us. They came to curse us. But at the end, they said, listen, it's state land. Then they were just kind of writing out their frustrations that the Jewish people are somehow able to settle this land, and there's really no legal problems with it. And it ended up being like, okay, great.
So yeah, it was really actually a spirit raiser and a confirmation that the drama that they talked about isn't even a drama. There's really nothing there. But go ahead.
Well, just to touch on that one point about how, you know, the story of Shimon and Levi starts really with the story of Shechem, and you know the conversation that they have with Jacob. Jacob is saying, why did you do this? And you shouldn't do this, and your anger got the best of you, and it kind of goes back and forth. And it's not really resolved, because at the end, Shimon and Levi say, you know, like, what, are we going to let them treat our sister like a prostitute? And that's sort of the end of the conversation there. So, I mean, who wins that conversation? There's no winner.
There's no last word.
Yeah, there's no last word. It's like, if anything, it's like Shimon and Levi sort of get the upper hand, that they end the conversation with them saying, listen, we did this out of righteous indignation. There was an attack on the people of Israel, on our family, and we were defending our family's honor and the nation of Israel's honor. And then we see then, like, generations later, you know, one way it could be interpreted that they were just a bunch of violent thugs, or were they really zealous for God and for Israel? And then it happens that Jacob says, well, I want you to know that because you acted out of anger, you will be dispersed among the people of Israel. And so, well, what
because
that
you're
mean?
Dangerous when you're together.
And so what does that mean, that they'll be dispersed amongst the people of Israel? Well, what we see now, it kind of like the story unfolds later, almost in a retroactive way. The future then defines the past, and says that Shimon, it seems like, is once again kind of just acting like a little bit of a thug. He's just like fornicating. And maybe you said that he has, you know, destined to be with a Moabite, but right in
front of... It's not justifying
like,
it. It's just
like right in front of the Ohel Moed, right in front of the tabernacle of meeting. Meaning it seems like pretty outrageous. And then Levi comes and once again in zealousness comes and deals with the issue. But it's interesting to see that both of them receive the blessing of Jacob, where Shimon's tribe is actually just swallowed into Judah, and Levi is dispersed among all of Israel, and he doesn't have a nachala, he doesn't have an inheritance in the land, because ultimately Hashem is his nachala, Hashem is his inheritance. And so when someone makes an action, Chazal on this parsha, they say that, you know, life is defined as a loan, that we're given this life. And what is a loan? If someone gives me a loan, what is that? If I give that money back 5 years from now, then the man who gave me a loan did a mitzvah, and I did a mitzvah by giving the loan back. If I don't give the money back, then when I took that money, I was actually doing a sin. It was an avera. It was a chet. So the future action defines the past. And so too, Shimon and Levi, their conversation, their identity, it was undefined. It's like, well, are you thugs or are you zealous for God? And generations later, it seems as though their actions then were defined by their future. The future almost determined what the past was. And ultimately, the words of Jacob came true. Neither of them had a lot within the land of Israel, but one's lot became the priesthood and to become Levites in the temple, where one just simply became assimilated into Judah. And so too, our lives, you know, we're given a loan. And it's like Hashem gave us this gift called life. And Tehillah was telling me this awesome, you know, she's constantly reading articles about science. She loves science. And they've just now discovered under microscopes that when the sperm meets and impregnates the egg at the first time, a small spark of light emanates from the egg.
The encounter.
Isn't that unbelievable? You know, in Kabbalistic writings, they talk about Hanitzotza Elohi, the spark of light that is the soul. And there's no explanation why it happens. They don't understand why it happens. But under the microscope, you see when life first meets, there's this little spark of light that happens. And it's like unbelievable that we've just discovered this now in 2018, that there is some sort of light emanations, like a sign of life that comes in is by the spark of light. So life is alone. And when that spark of light emanates, it's like, here, I've been given you a gift. And the future of your life will determine the past. And so like we may have made mistakes and we may have walked alone and we may have had stronger faith or weaker faith, but it's the future. Our actions today will determine the actions of our past. That even if we had stumbled, even if we had made mistakes, the actions that we have now truly transform whatever was in the past.
And why does it transform what happened in the past? Because only if we look at those mistakes and understand that they were also God's will, then we can use them as a launching pad, as a platform on which to stand, that we can reach the truth in a much higher, deeper way than we ever would have been able to without having made those mistakes. And which is why I want to say, you're talking about alone, that this world, this life is alone. Well, Caleb Waller came over with his family the other night and had dinner out here at the farm with us, and he said something when I told him about the challenge you're facing. He said it reminds him of a Jim Elliot quote. I don't know who Jim Elliot is, but he said, a man is no fool to give up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. And that really, it resonated as true, because yes, you could theoretically lose this place that you're giving up your house for, but the motivation, the service of it, is something you can never lose. And that's what really matters. And that's what I was talking about Pinchas sacrificing his nature for exactly that, this inclusivity, this exclusivity idea. Even Abraham, our sages say, the thing he struggled the most was with the idea of the Brit Milah, the circumcision, because it then, at first, it was his mission to bring Hashem to the whole world and everybody and all of mankind. And now with this circumcision, he's becoming a tribe and a nation, and it's no longer the universalism that he thought it was. And so there's this tension from all the way back then with the circumcision between the universal desire in the heart of every Jew and the tribalistic loneliness, the individuality that is the Jewish nation, where we're not the same as everyone else. And that's exactly, you know, this peace now thing, it's the same idea. And the truth is that we need to be able to hold both at once. We're a nation, which makes us different and separate, but we have a mission to bring Hashem to the world, which ultimately will bring true peace to the world, because when you bring Hashem to the world, you understand we're all brothers. So there are lines and there are boundaries, and we have to be inclusive but principled in our inclusivity. If Zimri was so sure that he was meant to be with Cosby, then he should have married her in the proper way, right? Have a conversion and married her and done it within the guidelines of what Hashem has laid out before us. The minute we start taking it in on our own and running with it to a degree where there's no principles, there's no fear of Hashem, and it's our own will and the way we think things need to be. So that's one of what do I think the national character trait that we need to overcome is? The need to always be loved. I think that's what we'll end the show with right now. We feel like we need to have the world love us. And because of that, we err on the side of inclusivity, even when it comes to sacrificing our own interests, our own relationship with Hashem, our own identity. We need to first and foremost come together and love each other and love Hashem and keep his words. And through that, the light will come out and our love will overflow to the nations of the world and Mashiach will come. Please, God, may it be soon in our days. Ari Abramowitz here. You can reach out to me, ari@thelandofisrael.com, jeremy@thelandofisrael.com. We always love to hear from you. We had emails flooding in from our last show. I have not had an opportunity to respond yet, but please know we read them all, and I plan on responding to them, and I'm sure Jeremy does as well. So thank you for being with us, and Hashem should keep all of you strong and guide your footsteps. Shalom, shalom.
And we believe in the state of Israel, believe in the army, and we hope they won't continue to make mistakes. But that doesn't stop our belief. We have the tremendous privilege card of Israel coming back to itself.
This week on Rejuvenation, I speak with Tammy Zilberschein, whose family was thrown out of their home in Netzarim in that terrible summer of 2005. Where did they go? Are they still connected to Israeli society?
Baruch Hashem, we celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut, and my children serve in the army very proudly.
Join me for a personal look at Gush Katif in 2005, only on Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network.